Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We didn't get to this yesterday, but walking back in the whim factor, speaking of Bush 41, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line, George H.W. Bush, the wimp. And I don't mean in a complimentary fashion, like a self, like Willie the Wimp and his Cadillac coffin. I don't mean
Who's calling him a wimp and why?
Well, you'll recall that was the appellation the D.C. press corps pinned on him when he was running for president.
Oh, that's right.
The Wimp Factor. It was a cover story in Newsweek, October 1987, and it stuck. The Wimp Factor. Evan Thomas was the responsible party. And over the weekend, he wrote a piece, "I called George Bush a wimp," on the cover of Newsweek, "Why I Was Wrong." The article didn't quite come out and declare Bush was a weakling, and I know that Bush's own advisors worried about the quote-unquote wimp label, but the clear implication of the cover story, which I edited and penciling in the word wimp over the objection of the story's reporter, Margaret Warner, was that Bush somehow lacked the inner fortitude to lead the free world. How wrong we were. This is... also picked up by Christopher Buckley, addresses it, Christopher Buckley, son of William F., the godfather of conservatism, and was a Bush speechwriter when he was VP under Reagan. He writes, "Mr. Bush's critics were constantly yapping at him for being preppy. At the 88 presidential as the 88 presidential campaign got underway, the war hero had been shot down while flying his torpedo bomber into a maelstrom of Japanese flak, found himself on the cover of Newsweek ridiculed for what it called his wimp factor. I never once heard Mr. Bush chafe at the preposterous notion that he lacked walnuts. He was serene about his manhood, and why shouldn't he be? If you had been to war as an 18-year-old pilot and seen death face to face, if you cradled your dying 4-year-old daughter in your arms, drilled for oil in Texas, raised a family, been elected to Congress, head of the Republican Party during Watergate, opened the first U.S. liaison office in China, ran the CIA, got yourself elected VP, maybe you didn't need to have your manhood validated by smart-ass magazine editors and the soft-faced thumbsuckers of the punditariat." He's got his father's flair for rhetorical flourishes. But this is a real thing, because it's a reminder that as much as we obsess about the D.C. press corps today as it pertains to Trump and how much they've changed, how antagonistic they are to Trump, they haven't changed that much in the last 30 years. They haven't changed that much. Bush was a wimp because you couldn't call him stupid, H.W.
They called him preppy.
W. Ooh. Was stupid because you couldn't call him evil. Reagan was the amiable dunce, according to Clark Clifford, picked up and popularized by the media. And Obama was manna from heaven. Obama was...
Well, he was a gift from God.
No, he was God. Exactly.
He's the second coming. Okay.
It's just very interesting. Think about what the D.C. press corps did. They turned a war hero into a wimp. Now contrast that with the elevation of this flim-flam artist named Barack Obama. We're supposed to emulate Barack Obama. He's the standard, according to the D.C. press corps, where a war hero like George H.W. Bush, the last one we've had, the last, obviously, World War II veteran to serve as president of the United States, compare that to how he was treated. So the antagonism today between President Trump and the D.C. press corps is nothing new. The difference is Trump, not the D.C. press corps. You see? It's such an important point, and I didn't want the lack of addressing how H.W. was treated. Now, he didn't treat the press back the way that Trump did, obviously, the way even Reagan, and you know, probably to his detriment. But it is worth noting this institution called the Fourth Estate, which has become the fifth branch of government, how they treated H.W. Bush. And just contrast that over just thinking about just the last three decades. Who we should ridicule and who we should emulate, as so defined by the press. And speaking of Bush and Reagan, we didn't get a chance to get to these bites yesterday either. But George H.W. Bush, not really known for his speechifying, but he gave a tremendous eulogy.
Oh, I remember that.
Of President Reagan. And he, it was really interesting because it was something that you didn't get a lot of from Bush 41, which is introspection that's then publicly disclosed. And that's what you got from him in his eulogy with Reagan, starting with an explanation from his perspective of why Ronald Reagan was so beloved.
Do you ever think, before we talk about the book,
why was he so admired? Why was he so beloved? He was beloved first because of what he was. Politics can be cruel, uncivil. Our friend was strong and gentle. Once he called America hopeful, big-hearted, idealistic, daring, decent, and fair. That was America, and yes, our friend. And next, Ronald Reagan was beloved because what he believed. He believed in America, so he made it his shining city on a hill. He believed in freedom, so he acted on behalf of its values and ideals. He believed in tomorrow, so the great communicator became the great liberator.
And what George H.W. Bush learned from Reagan, he gets emotional here, something you also didn't get very much of from George H.W. Bush in public.
As his vice president for 8 years, I learned more from Ronald Reagan than from anyone I encountered in all my years of public life. I learned kindness. We all did. I also learned courage. The nation did. Who can forget the horrible day in March 1981? He looked at the doctors in the emergency room and said, "I hope you're all Republicans." And then I learned decency. The whole world did. Days after being shot, weak from wounds, he spilled water from a sink. And entering the hospital room, aides saw him on his hands and knees, wiping water from the floor. He worried that his nurse would get in trouble. The good book says humility goes before honor, and our friend had both, and who could not cherish such a man? And perhaps as important as anything, I learned a lot about humor, a lot about laughter, and oh, how President Reagan loved a good story. When asked, "How did your visit go with Bishop Tutu?" he replied, "So-so." And it was typical. It was wonderful.
The other thing, and I didn't really realize this, Hugh Hewitt made mention of this, with respect to H.W. and his war record, he would routine, and Christopher Buckley jogged my memory on it, thinking about his comments as a former speechwriter. So when speechwriters would try to include his war record in political speeches, campaign collateral, he would
he didn't want to talk about it.
Right.
And even if you asked him in person, he'd not want to discuss it.
So that humility characteristic he described Reagan having, he very much had himself.
And he volunteered. I mean, he signed up as soon as he turned 18, and he went on 56 missions. So can you imagine, I mean, going back to when you're just a young lad, 18 years old, just graduating from high school, and you have a desire and a want and a need to serve your country.
Well, that's the,
I mean,
that's the thing.
Those times are gone for this generation.
He was patrician in manner, but manner doesn't necessarily make the man. Wimp? I don't think so.
Rude.
Chris on the Kennedy, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, all.
Morning.
Thank you. I just got to say, that's probably one of the greatest clips that ever existed, is that you just played from the National Cathedral, Bush talking about Reagan. But I've got to say, in many ways, the treatment of the media of Bush 41 and Bush 43, because of their inability to articulate just how much they were doing for the people of America, and the ability of the media to miscast them and misrepresent them constantly, day in, day out, really has brought us, in my opinion, the support that Trump gets. People are so sick of allowing these Beltway pundits and reporters, so-called, they're not reporters, they're editorialists, they're just so sick of being led by the nose by these people that they're standing up for Trump, even when Trump, you know, crosses a couple of lines, goes over a couple of boundaries, and I got to join them. I join them 100%. The biggest threat to democracy is the Beltway media lying constantly about either good stuff done by Republicans or bad stuff done by Clinton, the draft dodger, the two war heroes, or Obama, the flim-flam man.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Chris. Appreciate that. I mean, I think there may have been, I don't know. I don't know if it was a lack of recognition or just the style and the personality just wouldn't allow a Reagan or a Bush to go there to expose the Beltway media for who they are, the soft-faced thumbsuckers that Christopher Buckley described. Greg in Schaumburg. Hi, Greg. Hello, Greg.
Greg.
Greg in Schaumburg. Greg?
Greg.
Greg. All right. We'll search for Greg in the woods.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
There you go. Stevie Ray in the morning.
Oh.
Yeah. What do you mean? What is this?
I can't hear. I can't talk and I can't hear. I'm blind.
Mike's in there playing the air guitar.
This is right up his alley. I was dancing to the Bangles. I don't know what this stuff is.
Sure. Walking like an Egyptian.
Always.
Greg in Schaumburg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I didn't do anything the last time. I haven't changed a thing. But anyway, thank you for taking the call. I want to talk about 28 years ago and the start of the Iraq War on the 16th of January, 1990, 3 years before Amy was born. Got it in there, Dan. Okay. I think everybody kind of forgets how tense that night was because it was – go ahead.
No, go on. I'm sorry, I was coughing.
It was the big buildup during the fall. And, you know, Saddam supposedly had all this gas, and we didn't know what we were getting into. So, you know, that night, it just seemed like war changed. You know, with shock and awe, you had CNN guys, you know, that are suddenly standing. The stud guy, whatever his name was, you know.
But Bernie Shaw's under a table. Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. You know, the whole thing, like, changed, and it just seems like it's a totally different world now.
It was a televised war.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Strange.
And it was over so quickly. What, 3-4 days? Operation Desert Storm.
There was
lingering things to be done, but...
We ran the table,
yeah.
Is what you're trying to say. And yeah,
but it was the first, don't you agree, it was the first televised war where you felt like you were in with the reporters. You felt, you know, my heart was racing. Oh, my God, Bernie Shaw, is he going to live? Is he going to die?
Yeah.
Well.
Okay. sort of, but yes. Yes, the made-for-TV war. No, that's true. That was a market turn.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I want to get to the Yellow Jackets. Riots in Paris, not seen in, I don't know, half a century at least. But first, we were talking about the media's treatment of George Herbert Walker Bush, the wimp factor, now retracted, of course, now retracted by Evan Thomas at Newsweek, the responsible party. And just the what that reminds us about the D.C. press corps and what it's really always been, or certainly been in modern times, certainly since Watergate. So what we're seeing with the D.C. press corps today is not a difference in kind, just degree. Chris in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, so Dan and Amy, good morning for taking my call. I don't think that retractions are able to be considered lies. But what we see in right-wing propaganda reports are constant lies, such as, let's give some examples, right? Millions of illegals voting in the election, which is why Trump lost the popular vote. Hillary Clinton killing Seth Rich to gain the presidency. Hillary Clinton selling uranium to Russia as Secretary of State, which isn't even possible for Secretary of State to do. These are the lies that Trump supporters believe. And it's rampant. And there's no lies that those that are against Trump are believing here that are being reported by the media. The media is largely self-correcting.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
It's a free market in which if you scoop the media on anything, well, then you're gonna get your chance to shine. So why aren't all these scoops and calling out of the media's lies out there? I mean, we got Trump lying on a regular basis, and he's rallying against the media in order to get off away with whatever he can. Because when people don't believe the media anymore, as Trump supporters don't, he can get away with whatever he wants.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Chris. So here's the thing, Chris. Oh, I mean, without even going down the rabbit hole of Uranium One, because your characterization of the story is completely inaccurate. The importance of the story, Hillary selling uranium to the Russians. No, it's the company and leveraging her position as Secretary of State to facilitate the interests of that company and investors in that company. But go read Peter Schweitzer's book. Don't have time to get you up to speed. How many stories do you want me to provide as examples of what we're discussing? And you notice where the self-correcting media, you know how where they always err? It's weird, isn't it? They always err on the side of stories that are detrimental to Trump that they have to walk back in. And part of that free market of media and part of the reason the D.C. press corps is self-correcting is because they're called on it. But that, but you understand, you know, corrections appear the bottom of the second page back in the day when newspapers were in print. They don't get quite the same fanfare as the bombshell stories that turn out to be inaccurate. Let me give you an example, Chris, from Plainfield, so that you can share it with all of your all of those in your echo chamber. And you, when you discuss amongst yourselves the deplorables and what they believe and don't believe. Brian Ross, ABC News. Mike Flynn met with Russians at the behest of Trump.
He lost his job over it.
That's right.
I haven't seen him since, have you?
He go.
He was just being lazy, and he was trying to promote his narrative, and he just said it as fact.
ABC News. I mean, you know, talk about powerhouses and relative disparity of influence, since I know the left is very concerned about egalitarianism across the board with respect to money and, by extension, power, of course. So, of course, you're going to apply that same standard to the D.C. press corps, aren't you? I laugh. The secret climate change report the White House had, according to the New York Times, false. Another example. How many CNN reporters had to resign after over false stories of Russian links to further this evidence-free, fact-free conspiracy theory about Russian collusion. Scaramucci, Russian ties, false. Michael Cohen dispatched to Prague to meet with Russians, false. I could go on, and it's not just on Trump in particular, it's also on conservatism and positions and issues generally.
Well, the New York Times arrested to conservative groups. They were seeking, you know.
Well, yeah, the IRS targeting conservative groups under Obama, right. No accountability and no concern about freedom of thought, religion, speech by those guardians of our First Amendment freedoms on the left. Because they're not really guardians. They're guardians of speech and expression and thought that I like, and everything else needs to be eradicated. I mean, there are just examples. There's an example this weekend, NPR having to walk back in their story about Trump Jr.
What did they say again? They said,
I can't remember.
Mike in Bolingbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey. Yeah, hey, Dan, I agree with you 100% as usual, but, you know, that last caller dodged a bullet on that. You could spend all morning long talking about this. The one point I wanted to make, and you can reference it, I was watching Hannity last night. He did an 04 interview with then 41 as a father of the current president. And he saw this coming back then when they were making up false lies and things about his son. And, it's a pretty interesting interview, and he hit it on the head almost today, verbatim, of what they're doing today back there in 04 when this whole crap started. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for the call, Mike. The Trump Jr. thing was about Cohen's testimony. Trump Jr.'s testimony about Russian contacts conflicts with Cohen's, except it doesn't. It doesn't. The entire premise of the NPR story this weekend is incorrect, and they had to issue a correction because they got called on it. How about the Alexandria softball game shooting where the majority whip, Steve Scalise, was almost assassinated, among other congressmen? With the New York Times, they had to do a comparison to the Gabby Gifford shooting and falsely claim political motivations of the shooter in the Gabby Gifford case. And then
there
they had
no political affiliation with that guy.
And then they had to walk that back in after they got called on it. So that's in furtherance of, hey, you know, I know this was a Bernie Sanders supporter who shot up that softball field, but, you know, the right does it too. They have to come up with a, you know, they do it too way to level the.
Well, to level the playing field so they don't look bad.
Yeah. The whataboutism. New York Times, ABC, CNN. How many more examples would you like, Chris in Plainfield? As Mike in Bolingbrook said, I could give examples for 4 hours uninterrupted. And that's just at the D.C. level. They're not even getting to their regional outposts like in Chicago. Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, a good reporter would never have to walk a story back. It used to be that used to be the way it is. Now it's absolutely ridiculous. I got to tell you, I can't even watch the local news anymore. I mean, it's unbelievable. Back in the newspaper days and such, you read a story that had a lot, it had credibility to it. Nobody ever walked anything back because everything was factual. People did their homework, their due diligence, if you will. Nowadays, it's just absolutely, they spew anything they want. They get guys like that last caller. You know, it's not even news anymore. We don't even call it the news. It's entertainment now.
Thanks for the call, Marty. Appreciate it. I mean,
it's all about the reporter. You know, taking selfies again at double, triple homicides. I'll be on at 4:30 with the latest on the triple homicide. I mean, it's embarrassing. I feel sorry for them, and I feel sorry for the victims' family members that are covering because they don't care about them. They just care about, oh, does my hair look okay? How's my makeup?
And
it's a complete different world.
And here's the thing about what Chris said. Oh, you know, Trump voters don't believe the media, whatever his definition of the media is. His definition is probably the leftist outlets that I like. No, there are stories in the New York Times and on CNN and Washington Post and, you know, on and on, that I believe. They're the ones where evidence is presented and a logical thread exists. So, you know, you want to obsess about the outlets and play this stupid binary of this outlet versus that outlet. No, it's by story, actually. And it's the quality of the individual story. Do we have two unnamed sources or one unnamed source? Or is a New York Times reporter sleeping with her source on the Senate Intelligence Committee? Another example. Journalistic ethics, Chris in Plainfield. So it's the quality of the product, not necessarily the outlet that's branded over it. Am I more skeptical when it comes from CNN or MSNBC or New York Times? Yeah. You know why I'm skeptical? Because of their work product. Because of what they've been doing. Because of what they have said, the leading lights of the D.C. press corps, since Trump's election. Dispense with any pretense of objectivity. We are partisans now. These are pronouncements coming from The New Yorker and Politico, higher-ups. I mean, come on. Who's really not believing what they're hearing and reading? Well, of course, because you like what they're doing, so you just dispense with it. Mm-mm. No. But the flip side is, you haven't heard us pick up the Seth Rich conspiracy theory. We haven't talked about that on the show. We're conservative talk radio. Because we don't do conspiracy theories here. So because some other outlets will characterize themselves as conservatives and they do some evidence-free reporting, trying to connect things that may or may not be connected, but there's not much evidence to support it, and to pass that off as beyond reproach. No, we don't do that here. So not all outlets that have a center-left perspective are the same, and not all outlets that have a center-right perspective are the same. But those kinds of thoughtful, judicious distinctions are lost on the Chris's from Plainfield and their brethren.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
It's the season for giving, and we here at AM 560 are so appreciative of all the help that you've given us in the past, and we need your help once again this holiday season. We're trying to provide food for a year, water for life for 3,000 children in Haiti. A one-time donation of just $80, and that will provide food for a year and water for life. It's really important. These people have absolutely nothing, and I was down there, so I saw the looks on their faces. They are so appreciative of any donations. They're appreciative for clean water. The Food for the Poor has a huge facility in Port-au-Prince, and people line up every day by the hundreds to get clean water and just a bucket of rice and beans. And that's what literally it is. It is a bucket. And then they bring the bucket back the next day. But they need your help because they do not have any government or services to help them. They have nothing. They can't even go to the park to drink from a clean water fountain. So one-time donation. Call this number, 844-862-HOPE. That's 844-862-4673, or go to 560theanswer.com/food. And again, you guys help us every year. We need your help once again, and thank you so much for your generosity.
And what do Signature Bank, Matthew Hickey Law, Chris Jacobs, Century 21 affiliated, Palatine Complete Dental, AmericanEagle.com, Cafe Salsa, what do they all have in common?
I don't know, Dan. What?
They're all
business, they BBs?
They're all business benefactors. That's right, business benefactors. That's the other program that we're running again this year in conjunction with the individual donation piece that Amy just explained. And the way to participate in the business benefactor program and the benefit of it, you make a $2,500 tax-deductible donation to Food for the Poor, and we give you 40 60-second commercials that run primetime hours on our airwaves, Monday to Friday, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m., to profile your business. And the way to get enrolled in the program, like these other businesses I mentioned, call our sales manager. Her name is Ann Jeanette. Her number, 847-472-8951. Again, 847-472-8951. And Anjanette will get you all squared away and get your commercial on the way in production where Amy can
with the Kim Carnes voice?
On the voice so husky and Capella dog
sled. This is so annoying. I feel like I've gargled glass yet again today.
But I think the gravelly voice is good, isn't it? I like that. I think it's over it.
I can't project.
Yeah, this girl moved in across the street, and she came over because she wanted to play.
Well,
that was me earlier this morning.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go full froggy. I mean, I don't. Kim Carnes is what I was saying. You know, Betty Davis eyes. It's sultry. Kathleen Turner.
She's got Betty Davis eyes.
I stand corrected. Thank you.
But if you become a business benefactor, it really is the best deal in Chicagoland radio. 40 commercials for a $2,500 tax deductible donation. The money goes to food for the poor. So do something for your company while you do stuff for others.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
And she'll tease you, she'll unease you, have the best her just to please you. She's precocious, and she knows.
It's better when you're backing up Kim Carnes.
It's much better than going a cappella.
Yeah, no question about it. Dan and Amy, top of the morning. And hey, Illinois had a birthday yesterday.
Yay.
Our bicentennial, 200 years.
Did you get my card? I sent you Hallmark, and there's a, you know, Walgreens they were selling happy birthday Illinois cards. Mm-hmm. Did you get it?
I
sent it to your home, your pie in the sky.
I assume it had cash in it in honor of, you know, Illinois being synonymous with graft. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. How do you think it's going 200 years in Illinois? Yeah.
Balloon drops.
Yeah.
Confetti.
Sort of tepid. Is there anybody here to attend the party?
Hello.
Hello?
Hello. Hello.
We've got this.
We have this cake here to eat.
We've got this buffet table. Open bar.
It's all you eat, all you can eat buffet. Come on.
How is it going? So 200 years in, that's a pretty good probationary period. Should Illinois remain a state or should it be derecognized and turned into a territory? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And I say that, I suggest that, only because if we decommissioned Illinois as one of the 50 states, then we would no longer be the worst governed state in the history of America. So, you know, just trying to get out from under that title.
Right.
You know.
I've always thought we should have a Northern Illinois and a Southern Illinois. Break off into two starts, like North Carolina, South Carolina. Because I don't think it's fair to the farmers and the Illinoisans down south to pay for our Chicago politician sins and bad judgment calls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the fact that they line their own pockets
for
decades.
The Joe Biden three-state solution for Iraq just applied to Illinois.
Why not?
Suburbs is one state, Chicago's one state, downstate, south of I-80 is another state.
Yeah, I'm totally for it.
Or, as, I mean, for us up here, downstate, south of Taylor Street is southern Illinois. So south of Taylor Street would be another state.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I know, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Partitioning Illinois, decommissioning Illinois as a state. I mean, the one thing that we won't do, okay, which is why we've got to come up with these other solutions. The one thing that is off the table.
Stop spending money we don't have.
We're not doing that.
No.
Just stop with that reckless kind of talk.
Come on, Dan.
We're not. That is the one. That is a bridge. No. Uh-uh.
Amy, don't make me.
No. We are not. Yeah, we're not interested in solutions here. We're interested in papering over the self-inflicted problems that we've created. Well, that's their self-infliction. The Department of Redundancy Department. Chip in St. Charles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I heard Pritzker come out for the $15 an hour minimum wage yesterday, And I figure that's just his attempt to chase any businesses left in the state out before he comes into office.
That's his attempt to make good with those cashiers at the fast food restaurants that he regularly frequents, I think. Thanks for the call, Chip. Appreciate
There's
it.
There's buddies. Hey, throw in some bag fries, and I'll get you $15 an hour.
In honor of the 200th birthday of Illinois, lawsuit filed in district court, a couple of truck drivers at O'Hare, Hector Hernandez, Charles Termini, accused Deputy Chicago Aviation Commissioner Bill Helm and airport managers of carrying out a scheme that violated their constitutional rights and deprived drivers of thousands of dollars in overtime pay. They alleged that you had to do political work in exchange for overtime or you don't get no overtime. Well, I mean, that's not a big deal, but I'm just sort of on the 200th birthday. You know, you want to just kind of take stock, think about all of the great stories of this ilk, hire truck, and I mean, so many, and take a little bit of a walk down memory lane. Mm-hmm. Memories lighting the corner of your eyes. Greg in Jefferson Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know what? We ought to do like they did in Europe. We ought to allow all our neighboring states, Wisconsin, Missouri, Indiana, Kentucky, and so on, to take off part of Illinois, and then we can automatically jack up their property taxes to pay for all the pensions that these slugs in Illinois are owed.
All right, thanks for the call, Greg. Speaking of which, you know, we're not just talking about Chicago here. It's Illinois' 200th birthday, so how's it going? Well, how is it going in Norridge? Norridge officials moving forward on a property tax levy increase of 35%.
What?
To meet their police pension fund obligations.
See, once again.
Oh, boy.
Besides raising property taxes, how else can they fund pensions? I mean, are there any solid ideas out there? Anything?
Well, of course. I mean, there's ideas. Ideas isn't the problem. I mean, other states have public sector pensions. Other people who don't work in the public sector have retirement accounts. You've heard of this thing called the 401k?
I'm familiar. You know why? Because I have one.
Well, there you go. Yeah, no, there is a real world outside of Illinois. But I think one of the things that we need to do is see if we can get our Democrat congressman to redirect that border wall funding to put one of those translucent domes
over
Illinois to cordon us off from the rest of the country and also to prevent the exodus, because I think that's about what it's going to take. And not to mention, since we love to translate Simpsons episodes into real-life policy here, perfect. I mean, you got the Elon Musk monorail coming to town, Music Man style. Yeah.
Music Man style.
You got Norridge. So when's it going to happen? These pensions. When's it going to? It's to borrow from Michael Lewis. It's happening and it's continuing to happen. So let's just in the last couple of months, Norridge, Cal Park, Harvey, North Chicago, Evanston. It's everywhere. Oh, and oh, by the way, with Fritz Kagi as the new Cook County Assessor. That reassessment coming down the pike for Chicago, the graft that's gone on and the gimmickry that's gone on in the assessor's office under
Joe Berrios
and so many.
Where's he going?
And so many before him, hopefully at a federal prison, but we'll see. There's going to be a rude awakening for the city of Chicago denizens, I believe. When that assessment comes, in case you think that you're getting out of this, whether you stay or go unscathed, and I mean this state, you're wrong. And I don't care if you live in Cairo or Zion or anywhere in between. You are wrong. And I know we love it. We love it. We're masochists, Stockholm syndrome, some combination of the two. Low information voters, some combination of the three. I don't know. There's probably other pathologies or variables that I haven't included. But, Illinois at 200, taking stock, huh? What do you think? All of the great advantages of Illinois after we hornswoggled our way into statehood. There's a pretty good piece actually in the Tribune by Ron Grossman about how the fix was in from the beginning with Illinois, how Illinois Congressman Nathaniel Pope and his nephew Daniel Cook, for whom Cook County is named, sort of orchestrated Illinois statehood, even though we didn't have the population to qualify. Pretty good story. Also, if you want a story about the history of Chicago, a good read about the history of Chicago, I'd recommend The Outfit, which traces Chicago back to its ignominious beginnings, to its ignominious present, or at least ignominious present as of about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. Good reads, but you're living it. So, I mean, I don't need to tell you Illinois isn't broken, it's fixed, because you've been living it for as long as you've been here, right? And you love it. We love it. That's why we stay.
Real quick, I have a text message from my friend who should be getting a pension. They believe that they can get funded, their pensions funded by casinos if the state sells property or if they dip into the TIF funds. How much is a pension for police and firefighter? What's the debt level?
The combination is about $30 billion underfunded. So so tell your firefighter friend, appreciate it. And those are, I mean, I don't agree with all those proposals, but okay. What else you got?
Because it doesn't add up to $30 billion.
That's not close. And here's the thing. You can't make this math work. I don't know how many times to explain this, even to people who are well-intended. You cannot make the math work. So unless you want to talk about structural reform of pensions, if it's only how do we fill this abyss, the answer is you cannot.
Well, can we start with having people not double dip? I mean, if you had a county board position and then you were a firefighter or a police officer, they're getting double pensions. I mean, wouldn't that be a logical start, or am I just a crazy blonde?
It's just that's...
Who can't speak.
That's marginal. It's just that's not central to the problem.
Okay.
The problem is the benefit levels juxtaposed against the salary levels. You're having people with household incomes of 55 grand. You're putting them on the hook for guaranteed pension payments that are twice their household income. And for individuals, you're liquidating their homes. You're in process of doing that. We've been in process of doing that for some time. It's, you know, slow cooking the frog. So, again, legalize dope, legalize prostitution, put a casino. I mean, look at video poker.
Uh-huh.
Video poker, you look at a heat map of video poker. You cannot, you know, it's like gym class. Put your arms
shoulder length apart.
Shoulder
to the
length
next person next
yeah,
to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how far a video poker machine is from you at any given time in Illinois.
Really?
Look at a heat map. It's all red. So video poker, slots at O'Hare, Chicago casino, the mob economy, 200 years in, you know, we've gone to fully embrace the mob economy. So that's why I say, sure, legalize prostitution too. How about sex robot brothels? What else you got? Continue to find creative 9% amusement tax. We tack that on. So we got the PlayStations. We got your streaming services. What do you want to do? Make it 100% amusement tax? Make it 1,000% amusement tax? How about a city income tax? How about graduating the state income tax? How about a LaSalle Street financial tax? Fine.
Commuter tax, gas tax.
Right, commuter tax, right. How about increasing the real estate transfer fees? Communities are doing that.
Ugh.
Get you on the way in, get you on the way out.
No, it's the worst.
What else you got? $250 billion in debt? $135 billion in unfunded pension liabilities? And by the way, this has been in very good economic times in terms of market return. Do we have a recession? These pension funds stop circling the drain and they're down it. And, oh, by the way, Illinois Republican Party? I mean, this is a command control state, a government centric state, and the Illinois Republican Party. I mean, if this were a human body, the Illinois Republican Party is the appendix. It's a vestigial organ. It's here, but it doesn't do anything.
Well, real quick, how much money are in these TIF funds? And it's,
I mean, honestly, it's like, can people do your? I'm not talking about you. Hey, do your own homework. Stop just repeating whatever some dim-witted alderman or a leftist political hack has said on Chicago Tonight. There's like $500 million in TIF funds. What else you got?
Oh, that's nothing.
$30 billion.
And that's just for police and firefighters.
And the ticker keeps running. And that's just Chicago.
Oy.
And in these suburban communities, your services are going to be cut. Your property taxes are going up because the state will intercept funds that are going to municipalities and force them into pension funds if these municipalities don't come up with ways to make their state-mandated pension payments. Of course, that's, you know, not the case for the state. I mean, you know, what do you got? All self-inflicted problems. Here's the bottom line on pensions. And by the way, also on property taxes. You cannot have a system where teachers, police, firefighters put in $140,000 over 30 years and get a guaranteed $2.1 million back. It is not sustainable. I don't care how many vices you want to legalize and tax, how many sex robots you want built. How many?
So 140 and 2.1 million back.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, and that's not even getting to the you know, the 90,000 people making over 100 grand in the public sector, which, by the way, is 50% more than California with 1/4 the population. I mean, I could go on and on. The most units of government in the country. We're the 5th most populous state and declining, as you know. 6th, I think, now, right? We're behind. Didn't we fall behind Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
So 7,000 units of government. The next closest is Texas with 2,000 fewer and, again, 4 times the population. This is a structural problem. It is unsustainable like any Ponzi scheme. Like, oh, you know, when you ask this, like, well, what if we do this and what if we tax that? What if we, you know what you're doing? You're saying, how do we keep Bernie Madoff in business? How do we get more money into those Madoff funds so we can pay out those early investors and keep that Ponzi scheme going? That's what you're asking. How can we keep the Ponzi scheme going? You can't. All Ponzi schemes end. The longer they go on, the worse the ending for everybody. Art in Huntley, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Okay, very, very upset because, I mean, like you were saying, I mean, listening to you every day, you know, they tax you on everything. We might as well just send our check in to the mayor, and he'll send us whatever is left into us. But how can we can't have somebody that would actually watch? I mean, do you need 90 million for bus lanes? Do you need 105 million for bicycle lanes? I went down Elston Avenue from Milwaukee Avenue all the way to North Avenue on a good day, on a summer day, 3 bicyclists. And we're spending all that money on all the BS and all the flowers. I mean, flowers look nice, but put something in the bushes that come back every year. Why do we have to spend $5 million on flowers on Michigan Avenue and all the other streets? And I mean, this city is run like a piece of crap. And like Amy said, why do these people have 2 pensions? Deputy police superintendent is now all of a sudden the streets and sanitation commissioner making $380,000.
Yeah,
what's
right.
Ridiculous. I mean, this, who the heck's going to step up? I mean, really, I'm getting so disgusted every time I go into the city. I mean, and the crime, you know, half of that crime ban in the Michigan Avenue area is not reported. A friend of ours is a sergeant down there, and he's always, you don't know the half of it.
Well, of course.
They don't want to put it on.
Of course they don't, because that's, you know, that's the golden goose. That's right. Thanks, Art, you know, along with Navy Pier.
And just so you know, there are perennials and some flower boxes, and the annuals are in the hanging baskets. I just know that because my grandma was a horticulturist.
All right, we're going to make you the horticulture czar.
She was a horticulturist.
Under Mayor Preckwinkle. Jim in Tampa.
Good morning, guys. I want to say I love Chicago. I grew up there. And so I want that to be remembered when I say this. But to Illinois residents, you come across as the drunk guy at a party that is looking at the girl and thinks she's beautiful, and she isn't. And you just have to see, this is how we the rest of the country looks at you guys. It's time to get on with this and get out of there. That's what you need to do. And I love Chicago. Mm. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jim.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
By the way, this TIF districts, $660 million is what the city TIF districts generated last year. Cook County wide was $1 billion. City, $660 million. So that's a lie that's being told and being repurposed. Lie. Not true. Get your facts straight.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The market reacted positively to the news out of the G20 this weekend that there is a 90-day truce that starts January 1 between Xi and Trump, between the U.S. and China, with respect to the tariff escalations. No more tariff escalation for the first 3 months of next year, at least. Kudlow said the weekend's agreement was an enormous event. He also said the Chinese have agreed to begin dropping non-tariff barriers immediately, although it was unclear just exactly what those non-tariff barriers that would be discarded are. He also said they're pretty close to agreements to combat intellectual property theft and forced transfer of technology. I'm a bit skeptical.
Who's going to be policing that?
Well, exactly. For more on this topic and an answer to that question, we're pleased to be joined by Jim Urio, CNBC contributor and local restaurateur. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So your reaction to this temporary trade truce?
Well, I don't know that my reaction to it. Let's talk about the market's reaction, because I found it very, very interesting, is that the stock market and the bond market beginning Sunday night had a little bit of a disagreement, and because the bond market acted like it was no big deal, and the stock market was up 50 handles on Sunday night. The stock market tends to be more emotional. I tend to go with the bond market more, and when you combine those two together, what it is mildly positive. When Larry Kudlow spoke in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, he said the first and most important thing is to get China to say yes to anything, and I guess that checks the box that they're at least agreeing to sit down at the table. But if this news was a big deal, like, I don't know, you guys, a lot of times people outside the market look at this technical analysis stuff as some sort of voodoo, and it's not. I'm not going to harp on technical analysis, but we put highs in the stock market in the beginning of November and the middle of October, and we couldn't eclipse those highs based on the news, even though we came off 7% off the lows in a week and a half, which is an enormous deal. But if this news was really huge, we'd be above those highs, and we'd have blue skies ahead of us.
Well, Trump said that China is going to cut tariffs on American cars. Can you explain?
I cannot explain. I don't think anyone can explain. I think that the words that are said to me are not as big a deal as the market's reaction to them. And I think that even if everything went away right now, we went back to the world we lived in a year ago, let's say, where China did still take advantage of us, I think that everything that's happening, yes, China would know that they had leverage, which they knew they had it anyway. But the takeaway from that is that we are not going to sit by idly, and we're willing to keep an eye on them. And yes, it would be a loss, but it wouldn't be just an absolute wipeout.
Tyler Cohen, writing in Bloomberg on Monday, or I think it was over the weekend, actually, but not a huge Trump fan, but he gave some begrudging credit for this temporary trade truce. He said, instead of sweeping everything under the rug, as was the case before Donald Trump, as was the case before Trump took office, America and China have found a new way of addressing conflict by talking openly. And you think that's positive, in addition to some of the other ancillary positives, like China agreeing to put a kibosh on the export of fentanyl into the country, to try to do their part to tamp down the opioid crisis and things like that on the margins. But what about this larger point he makes that this is no longer just kind of sweep it under the rug, go along as it's always been, like you were suggesting, and now this is all brought out into full public view?
I couldn't agree more. And we look at this, and I think you and I have talked about this before. There are so many things that Donald Trump has done from the macroeconomic picture that I really, really loved. This is the one wild card, because this whole time we thought China doesn't have to run for re-elections. They don't care as much if their people are suffering a little bit because of the trade war. And that made it somewhat of a scary proposition to me to enter into this with them. But the fact now that they're willing to talk, and it'll never go away. You know, you can't unring this bell. That means that we pulled back the curtain and said, you know what, you guys steal our technology. I've always thought that that's the biggest part of this,
yeah,
is that we have to put a stop to that. I mean, I have friends in the technology business. When they would go to China, they were instructed by their companies they could not even leave any piece of technology in the hotel room, even if they went out to a restaurant at night, because, you know, it was going to get stolen, it was going to get copied, and all of a sudden, you know, whatever company you worked for, you would not have cutting edge any longer.
But here's the problem, and this is more of a political question than perhaps an economic one, but you're a man of letters. I think you're equal to the task.
I hope so.
You got China has this problem inside the country because, you know, they're communists. We sometimes forget about that. So they control the majority of the means of production, which means they are not realizing the economic strength of their numbers. And they got 1 million people a day migrating to the cities. And if they don't create, quote unquote, 25 million jobs a year, they have the prospect of revolution. The question is, yes, they're a communist in a command control society, but they do have to, you know, keep the populace somewhat sedate. You know, it's sort of like Illinois. And so the question becomes, how do they walk away from their business model, which is this intellectual piracy, before they address the suffering that they're willing to inflict on their populace to maintain this business model? Because they don't have another way to satiate the public to the level they need to, do they?
No, but you hit on the key thing, is that here, and even in Europe to a certain degree, to a smaller degree, we have to worry about job security and re-election. They do not. The only thing they really have to care about is being beheaded in the square and some sort of revolution happens. Now, I think that's a real worry, and they have to, but their range of allowing people to suffer is far greater than ours. But now, what's interesting is you look at what's happened in France, and I don't know what to believe in the media, mm-hmm, because whether or not the whole city's erupting or is it just one little square block. But let's assume that it's a significant protest, let's call it. You know, we were told by the left that people should want to pay higher taxes and be controlled more by the government. As it turns out, maybe that's not the case. They're looking at France, which is shocking to me and you, I'm sure.
Yeah, right. $7 a gallon in France is as much as they're willing to pay. They don't want that 30 cents
not
increase
anymore.
And
it's affecting tourism because a lot of people have canceled their trips there and they're not shopping and it's Christmas time, so they need that revenue.
Amen. And you guys believe that the city of Paris is erupting, or you think that's somewhat of a media media creation, or do you think it's real?
No, I think it's real.
Okay, good. Then so do I. Then
okay.
Okay. Well, good. Also,
I'm convinced.
Yeah, at the G20 summit, President Trump signed the new NAFTA, and what's it called, Dan?
UMCA.
What did we get out of the deal, and how different is it than NAFTA?
You know what? I have not dug and deconstructed that as much as I should have, because what I do remember is I look at when these deals get signed, I look at the reactions in the dollar, the currency of the countries that are affected by it, and see what the market's interpretation of it is. Not only because that's the way I make money off it, because that's much more the real interpretation. Like, if you look at all these different stories on Sunday night, if you listen to CNN or you listen to Breitbart, you get two completely conflicting stories about what happened in the China agreements. And so you have to wait to see how about 10 different markets digest it before you think it's a big deal. And that one in particular doesn't seem like a big deal because we haven't seen much of a reaction. What's a bigger deal is, you know, the pound and the euro are up today because we are believing that that there's a chance that this Brexit thing will never happen, which, by the way, I know I placed $100 on the square that said there will never be a Brexit the day after the election, because I think the one thing that Europe is good at is kicking the can down the road.
Well, I just want to nail you down on China. So with respect to changing their business model, the pronouncements that have come and may come about a deal on intellectual piracy and just the general technological theft that's forced transfer of technology and general theft that's part of the Chinese business model. I mean, is there any way that that goes away?
No, I don't think it goes away, but I don't even think that's the goal. I think that is to begin to control it and begin to keep an eye on it and hope that it doesn't, you know, just run wildly like it has in the past. I think these goals, like when Donald Trump began down this path, I think he just wants China to come our way on something. And I base that on the speech from Larry as well. Just say to us that you're willing to work with us on things, and then we'll be happy. I don't think that you're going to change them into the perfect trading partner anytime in the next, I don't know, 50 years. Like you said, it's their business model, but I don't think that matters. I think the market would be perfectly happy if we got one or two concessions from them and then everything reverted back to the way it was. And yes, they're going to tariff things. A lot of countries tariff our goods, but not as much as they had in the past, and now they know we're keeping an eye on them.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, I think those yellow jackets could come to the UK if there's no exit from the EU.
I think so, too. I think there's probably a certain part of the population that's like, well, gosh, what did we vote for? This seems more complicated than we had originally thought. But I do think that there's going to be a lot of angry people, and they're angry at the EU, and you hear these stories about you're no longer allowed to criticize migration. It's becoming against the law. That's absolutely terrifying, and it should be to anybody who lives there or looks at it.
All right, since you're a restaurateur, Brandt's there in Palatine, which reportedly has the best burger in Chicago.
We need to go there.
True story. You need to go, and we'll do a show from there. It'll be fun. We'll have burgers, and you can witness it firsthand.
Yeah.
But by the way, the oil prices going lower, I think, is a nice thing for the restaurant business as an aside. We haven't mentioned oil at all, and I think it's a big deal that oil's gone, you know, down $25 a barrel in the last month.
Well, how does that help you?
I think it puts more money in people's pockets. Oh, I think it puts you in a good mood, especially when you're out in the northwest suburbs in areas where it's a mixed financial picture. I think there's plenty of people who treat themselves when they feel like they're doing a little better.
Yeah, and you even tip the maitre d' at Brandt's, Jim Urio.
Yeah, as well, you should. Yeah, the more the better.
So this piece in The Atlantic, How Restaurants Got So Loud, sort of fascinating, talking about the architecture of restaurants. I live a lonely life. One of the things that is mentioned here is that architects are designing restaurants to be louder because they're more profitable. It gives the place a sense of energy and vibrancy. And so I wonder if that's the... Is that how it's like at Brandt's, or will it be?
When I walk at Brandt's, Brandt's is about 130-year-old building. People were a lot smaller back then, so it's a small and it's tight quarters. But when there's an energy and people's voices are all kind of blending together and there's a sound of music, it's a much better environment. And I'll come in there. I come in there every day about 5:30, right when the dinner hour begins. And if the people before me have forgot to turn the music to the right level, those kind of things irritate me, because I think it's hugely important to have your restaurant feel like it's buzzing.
Yeah.
And we get a good crowd, so it usually is buzzing.
Oh, sure.
Of course.
All those rock and rollers in here. Palatine in Northwest Cook County. Yeah. Sure.
You are still doubters. Both of you, I can tell by your voice.
Of
the hamburger, Brandt's Palatine. We must prove this. We must rectify this situation. Come on out.
All right.
You're in downtown Palatine?
No, it's not. It's over by Northwest Highway and Quinton Road.
Yeah, sure. All right. Okay. All right.
We're gonna
work on that, because I like burgers for breakfast. Jim Urio, CNBC contributor, proprietor of Brandt's in Palatine. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll see you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So teachers in West Suburban Geneva School District 304 walking the picket line today. That's out Kane County way.
And they've got a protest song, Dan.
Oh, good.
Oh, there's a few. Here's the first.
Stick with South End Lane, you simply can't go wrong.
Is that, you know, they haven't had a race
wait,
since.
Wait, I didn't hear that one.
All right, here. Ready.
Stick with South End Lane, you simply can't go wrong.
What's the first part? You simply can't go wrong. What's the first part?
I don't know. One more time.
Yeah.
Stick with South End Lane, you simply can't go wrong.
You know what they could use if they've got a choir teacher there? Yeah. Maybe get that protest, that picket line together and try to harmonize
cheer,
a bit.
Yeah, the second cheer is more articulated. You can understand what they're saying. They haven't had a raise since the 80s.
It hasn't changed since the 80s.
Did you get that one?
It hasn't changed since the 80s.
Yeah. Huh. So that's what they're fighting over, funding.
Is that right?
Yeah. And this is what the teachers want. They said that the newbies are getting more money than the people that are more established, that have 2 degrees.
We're hoping that we can get it done.
A step in lane schedule ensures that the public sector job of an educator is compensated adequately for how they progress across their profession.
19-year career teacher with a double master's who invested in her education and is doing a great job in a classroom, 4 years from now is going to see a 1.2% increase.
Yeah, and now some teachers are deciding whether they should stay in the district or move out.
It will determine whether I stay in Geneva for my career or have to start looking for jobs elsewhere.
Are they right?
Well, here's...
Because I know that's the popular opinion.
Yeah.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Give the teachers what they want? Question mark?
Mark Grasso, board president, said this is fair.
Bring some of the starting pay of our beginning teachers up, yet maintaining the salary for the teachers that are on the top end of our salary.
Okay, do you want to hear some other numbers that are contemplate the taxpayer in this conversation? Because I know we're not supposed to think about the taxpayer. That's according to the Chicago Press Corps and how these stories are covered, how these teacher strikes are covered. Those teachers versus the school district. What about the group financing at all? Do they get a seat at the table? Oh, I know. They're taxpayers too. Right. How about the overwhelming majority of taxpayers then? Do they get a seat at the table? Are they part of this conversation? So here are the facts. School District 304 has seen its enrollment rise by 48% over the past 20 years.
Wow.
Oh, 48%, obviously. So it's we got to keep up with the times. That's why you have to spend more money and track more talent, all that, right? Not exactly.
Well, it was a sleepy town. Now it's hip and hopping.
Yeah. And the tax revenue for the school district during that same 20 years?
How much?
Has increased by 70%.
Oh.
48% enrollment, 70% increase in tax revenue for the school district from 39 to 95 million. That's according to the Illinois State Board of Education. The Illinois State Board of Education, the source on this data point for the not since the 80s ditty they were offering up. The median teacher at District 304 earns approximately $120,000. For, you know, their 3/4 of a year of work. $120,000. When you include salaries plus benefits. Which is, you know, burdened wage, your burdened salary. Other interesting thing about this, if you're a taxpayer, I mean, I don't know if you care about your property taxes. I truly don't know. Based on how people behave, I have no idea. But just for your own edification, the median property tax bill for a homeowner in School District 304 is $8,600. That's about 2.5% of median home value, which is about 2.5 times the national average. Oh, and by the way, you won't be surprised to learn that home prices in Geneva, real dollars, if you look, if you do a 5-year look back, 10-year look back, 20-year look back, they are static to declining depending on how far you look back. Because here's another economic axiom for you to share with your less economically literate friends. Property taxes go up, home values go down. Inversely proportional. Property tax, let me repeat that, because I know this is a complicated formulation, at least as far as I can tell from the behavior of the Illinois electorate. Property taxes go up, home values go down. Everybody got it? So again, 120 grand. You already pay, and by the way, whatever comes of this contract, this is largely going to be borne by local property taxpayers. 93% of the school district 304 funding comes from local property tax.
And what the board is offering, an increase for starting salary by 12% over 4 years, and veteran teachers' pay would increase 4.2% over their same 4 years.
Mm-hmm. The Teachers Association, the Teachers Union, wanted increases of 18%, 6% a year for the next 3, as well as taxpayers to pick up 100% of the health care benefit costs. Currently, it's only 95% for single teachers, and 75% of the cost for teachers with families. Currently, it's only 65%. You want to write that check?
Yeah. Imaginary money that we have.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. 120 grand burden wage, 95% pickup by the taxpayers of your health care, 60% for singles, 65% for family. They want 18% over 3 increase in salary, plus 100% for single on the health care, plus 75% for family. All right. Okay.
They also want to increase pay for coaches. Well, stipends paid off for teachers who lead sports teams and other activities.
Yeah.
Why don't they just do it for free? Like someone I know. For the love of the game.
Yeah. How, anybody interested in looking at what you pay versus how the schools are performing? Anybody want to have that? No. I'm sorry.
Don't be silly.
How much
Dan.
More should we give teachers? That's the only conversation that matters. Got it. Elizabeth in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. I'm not in Oak Brook. I'm in Oak Park.
Oh, Oak Park. Sorry.
Yeah. And I've called a couple times before. I sold my house in Oak Park. We actually close on Friday. You know, I paid a ton in property taxes. Mm-hmm. But on the way out the door, Oak Park sweetened it with an exit tax of $5,400.
Oh, my gosh.
In order to get out of my house, I kind of slashed the price. You know, the realtor was clueless about what was going on in the market. She didn't have any idea about taxes or anything like that and the impact on home value. So we listed it at a price that I was a little skeptical about. But in order to get out, I pretty much sold it for 80% of what her list price was. And then paid the exit tax on the way out. But I just wanted out. I want out of Illinois. I'm going to live in Crystal Lake for a couple years with my husband-to-be, and then we're going to move someplace more friendly.
All right.
An exit tax.
Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. Yeah, that's the real estate transfer tax. That's the exit tax that all these municipalities are hitting people with, too.
Do we have that in Chicago?
Yeah.
I can't remember. It's been a while.
Oh, yeah. And it's fairly high, too. It's higher than most of the suburbs. But, hey.
To sell your house, you have to pay a tax on it.
Well, look, I mean.
That is so wrong.
But, I mean, can you really quantify good government? Is there any price you wouldn't pay for good government? For the kids. For the quality schools you think you have.
For the children who love their students.
Is there anything you wouldn't pay to continue this self-delusion? I mean, right? Raise your hand, you blank check writers for self-delusion, because I know you're out there. Kevin in Bolingbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Best show on radio, Fifar. Listen, got a question for you. I've been listening a long time. You talk about these tax items, and my question is this. Do you have any comparative information on what Illinoisans make in salary on a per family basis in comparison to some of these other states? Because the taxes here are ridiculous, and when I move, I'm taking my company with me out of here. But the question remains, do we as Illinoisans make more than others make so they can have a lower tax rate on the property? That's the question.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Kevin. Well, I mean, again, we pay the highest property taxes in the nation in the suburban areas. The overwhelming majority of those taxes go to fund K-12 education, which is one of the reasons I have this idea to completely change the way we do K-12 funding so we can change the liquidation of your home by local governments. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of median salary, so Chicago is the only comparison I know offhand, but you can sort of extrapolate from the property taxes locally to compare that to other states. If you're paying the highest property taxes in the nation, you're financing the most government spending in the nation because that's where your property taxes are going. And what's the majority of the money spent in school districts? 80-85%? Salaries and benefits. So, yeah, you can kind of reverse engineer the answer. In Chicago teachers make, adjusted for cost of living, make the most money in the nation. Median salary is the highest in the nation when you adjust for cost of living, higher than New York, higher than L.A. And obviously, you see the performance of CPS, so end of discussion. Byron in Lombard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I listen to you guys every day, but this one is really particular interest to me. Couple of things. I've been looking on Zillow for quite a while now at the impact of property taxes on houses. If you've got 137 houses about over $1 million in Hinsdale trying to be sold, you look at these houses and you're seeing a reduction in the price anywhere from 8 to 49%.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a relative trying to sell a house in one of the suburbs over there, and they're down $250,000. And nobody understands you're not getting anything for your property. And another thing that's interesting is when you amortize how much you paid for the house and what you're selling it for, some people are getting a 0.5% of interest a year on their investment. And it's where do we turn to? What do we do?
I mean, Byron, I mean, it's a great example you give. It's real. And what did Hinsdale do? And what did so many of those denizens of Hinsdale and Burridge try to do? I mean, mostly Hinsdale, jam through a $160 million bond issue that thankfully was defeated on the November ballot. I mean, people are oblivious or indifferent or some combination of the two. I don't know. But people in this state hate their money and hate their property value. I mean, at least not everybody, of course, but the majority, because look at the political leadership of this state. I don't know how you get around the political leadership of this state says to everybody, this state hates money and hates property value unless it's being sent to the government.
But then isn't it because Chicago keeps electing
Chicago,
the bulk of people,
Chicago,
go to Springfield?
Yeah. No,
the entire collar counties were swept away just about. I mean, Roskam and Hultgren and all those state legislators that lost in DuPage lost countywide. You lost a countywide clerk.
I called
Will County Breen's lost the board.
Office. I called Breen's office out here a couple of times and emailed him and said, hey, my property taxes are too high. And they said, you know, the people in Glen Ellyn like spending money on improving the schools. They really don't care how much. That's what I was told 2 years ago.
Well, yeah.
True.
I mean, look who they elected.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Byron. I mean, I don't know. I tell you, the answers are not complicated. Explaining the decisions is a bit complicated or curious. But again, all self-inflicted. Why isn't somebody doing anything? Because you said we like it. I just don't know. Dan in the Southwest Side.
Hey, Dan and Amy, great show as always. You know, I just wanted to echo what Byron said, but I'd give a Southwest Side version of it. There are dozens and dozens of houses that go on and off the market in, let's say, the Palos and Orland Park area. And these houses were built for $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 plus. And these people can't get rid of them unless they lower it down to $400,000 or $500,000. And obviously the property taxes stay high, but the property values are obviously half of what the people built them for. So it's a conundrum that the local municipalities are really going to have to deal with. So I'm glad you're bringing attention to it.
Thanks for the call, Dan. And here's the thing. You think you're getting a deal when somebody drops their home price a couple hundred grand like in Palos.
You're just a sucker.
You're just you're the next one to get fleeced.
Yep.
You're not getting a deal.
You're getting robbed and you don't know it.
That's the market rate based on the destructive multiplier effect of ever escalating property taxes. Hey, Vey. Rick in Downers Grove.
Oh, hey. I love your show. And you're really into, you know, what's going on in the state and all that. And I'm completely anti-teacher because not one of them ever goes on strike and says, gee, I hope this doesn't raise property taxes. They want theirs and they want theirs now and they don't care. So when is it going to collapse? And I really hope it does. I want to see teachers go to their mailbox, get their pension check, and it's half what they think it's going to be. And the other half's an IOU from the state of Illinois. I mean, I really want that to happen. And when do you think it's going to happen? If it ever does, because it seems like it just keeps going on forever and ever and ever and nothing really significant happens.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Well, TRS is about 50% funded, so it'll be police and fire pension funds like in Chicago before it'll be teachers.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
We're almost halfway there. We need to cross the finish line in our annual Food for the Poor campaign here at AM 560, The Answer, and we need your help. We're talking about Haiti and helping the people in Haiti. I know, why not donate here? Well, people in Haiti, there's no social safety net to care for hungry children and families. And we see our tax dollars here serving that purpose all the time. However, in a country like Haiti, where the government is so corrupt and the people are destitute, there's no safety net. There, thousands would be dead if it were not for Food for the Poor. They help with clean water. They help with food distribution. Anything you need. The kids need to see a doctor. There's a line people have to wait in, but that's how they help the people that are malnourished. And we need your help. We're asking for a one-time donation of $80. With that, it will provide food for a year and water for life for a child or an adult in Haiti. Here's what you do. Call this number. It just takes 2 minutes. Make a donation on behalf of a well-fed loved one or grandchild. The number is 844-862-HOPE. 844-862-4673, or simply go to 560theanswer.com/food.
And then it's our business benefactor program. Again, Food for the Poor, five-star charity, Navigator rated. 95 cents of every dollar raised goes to the recipients to provide food and water for these children in Haiti. The business benefactor program, $2,500 tax-deductible donation to Food for the Poor is what you give. And then we here at AM560 give you 40 60-second commercials to promote your business on our airwaves. Those commercials will run primetime hours, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. on the weekdays. And you just call our sales manager, Ann Jeanette is her name, and her phone number is 847-472-8951. Again, 847-472-8951, and Ann Jeanette will get you signed up.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Remarking on the passing of George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41. I don't know if you saw this 1999 interview he gave with Larry King, so his son, W, of course, running for president at the time. And he was asked the dynasty question, the Bush dynasty question. The response was instructive.
Yeah. Do you ever think, before we talk about the book, that your family, like the Adamses, Kennedys, and Roosevelts, have become an American political dynasty?
Well, we don't like the word dynasty.
What would you call it?
I tell you what we do, that now that I'm out of politics and And literally, I mean, I don't go to Washington, I don't testify, I don't write op-ed pieces. I had my chance, it's my son's chance. And what Barbara and I do is just take pride. You show me a picture of your kid. I take the same pride in George and Jeb as I did when they could hit a triple in Little League. And they're governors of two big states.
But you don't think about your father and the whole family was in politics like the Kennedys. I mean, when you think about it, the Adams, Kennedys, Roosevelts, and Bushes are four American political families.
Well, we haven't got that far along that we think about it in that legacy or dynasty terms. It's hard to differentiate. It's more.
Do you ever think about being first father?
Yeah, I do. With enormous pride in our son that's trying and respect for anybody that gets into this tough arena these days. Those on the other side. I mean,
You miss it?
I don't. I honestly, Larry, I don't. I had my chance, and I don't miss it.
And he just had a life of public service. I mean, from being a congressman to a CIA director to World War II aviator, combat pilot. I mean, he did it all.
He did. It was a fascinating life and his perspective on political dynasty, because what Larry King said in setting it up, boy, I mean, that just, of course, was further codified with Jeb's tenure as governor of Florida and then W going from governor of Texas to two-term president. For more on the Bush 41 legacy and some other current geopolitical matters, we're pleased to be joined by our old friend Sebastian Gorka, former deputy assistant to President Trump, author of the book Why We Fight, Defending America's Enemies with No Apologies, and also a forthcoming host on these airwaves starting January 1. America First is the name of his program, and it'll be on our schedule at 10 p.m. in the evening. Sebastian Gorka, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good morning, guys.
Morning. So in the foreign policy arena, much has been said about Bush 41's administration of the end of the Cold War, as well as obviously the success of Gulf War I, although there's this nagging criticism in some quarters about his decision not to go on to Baghdad to take out Saddam. How do you assess his foreign policy prowess as a president?
I think the most important point with regards to his legacy internationally is this is a man who, one of the few presidents, I think he and Trump have a similarity in that they inherited a world in which everything was changing geopolitically, geostrategically. In the case of Bush 41, it was the end of the Cold War, and the way that he managed that transition in a way that did not lead to a kinetic conflict is to be deemed remarkable. This is a man who served his nation for practically half a century, from being the youngest naval aviator to being president. That's quite stunning. The sad thing with regards to his legacy today is how a man who was constantly lambasted by the left, by the so-called mainstream media, is now being praised by the same people who criticized him purely as a way to bash and get at the current Republican incumbent in the White House. So a great man, a patriot, a true servant to this nation, but a man whose legacy is being used for partisan political purposes. It's quite saddening.
Well, why do you think America didn't embrace him for a second term?
I'm not going to speak for all Americans. I think there were some expectations. There was that infamous moment, read my lips, no new taxes. Why did, for example, after World War II, the British not embrace Winston Churchill? Winston Churchill, who saved Western civilization almost single-handedly, was voted out of office right after World War II. Populations, voters can be fickle people, and that's the right you have in a democracy.
Wanted to get your take on the Yellow Jackets in Paris. 280,000 people from across France pushing back against gas tax increase, in particular a 30-cent tax increase imposed by Macron and his fellows to wean France off fossil fuels, not being received particularly well. out on the hustings. And I wonder if what we see from the Yellow Jackets, the Miserables, if you will, is comparable to the revolt by the deplorables in this country.
Big difference. Deplorables don't set the streets on fire. That's Antifa. That's the left-wing demonstrators that cause damage and destruction in their wake. Yeah, Macron is in trouble. His popularity is beneath 30% now. He sold himself as an outsider. He sold himself as a kind of Donald Trump, a person who's not part of the political establishment. But unlike Donald Trump, he has shown himself to be a hostage to globalizing forces and to the established lobby groups, special interest groups. And that's why you see the working class. That's why you see the French people say, you're not representing France. In my book, Why We Fight, there's a photograph of one of my proudest days in the White House when the president stood in the Rose Garden, pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accords. And then there's a famous sentence he spoke. He said, I was elected by the citizens of Pittsburgh to be the president of America, not the citizens of Paris. That's what America First means when a head of state like Donald Trump represents American interests, American workers. Macron said he was going to do the same, and he's not. He's kowtowing to the interests of the unrepresentative, unelected officials in the EU, and the French people are sending him a message that maybe he should be a little bit more nationalist, just like Donald Trump.
Right, certainly after he gave Trump the lecture about nationalism.
Right.
But I just want to stick on this. Setting aside the violence, and I of course, agree with you about that.
And on that point, just one point.
Okay.
You know, the goal of Macron to lecture us with the president sitting in the front row of the dangers of nationalism, President Macron, if it weren't for American nationalism, you would be speaking German today.
But on this revolt, setting aside the violence, do you see some strains of hope for Western Europe by seeing people from the countryside going to the big city to tell the big city socialists something about their interest in their own livelihoods and not sort of the religion of environmentalism, environmentalist extremism, or globalism?
I do potentially. I have no idea of predicting where it's going to go in France or Europe more broadly. I think, you know, Brexit showed you the level, the depth of dissatisfaction with the elite politics of the European Union. If you look at the midterms here in America, there's clearly a split between the urban areas and the rural areas. And yet again, this is exactly why Donald Trump won. His platform was about the forgotten men and women who have not been served well by either side, whether it's Democrat or GOP, who simply seem to serve their own interests. So, yeah, and look, if you look at the recent results, the political, if you look at the elections in Hungary, in Austria, in Italy, the Brexit itself, there is a tide of resentment. What it will result in, nobody knows.
Now, I recently saw you on television, I think it was last night, where you were ripping a neighborhood in Washington, D.C., who actually want to name a street after Khashoggi.
Yeah.
What is that? What and why in the world would they want to do that?
Yeah, incredible. Truly incredible. Yeah, a district in Washington, I think that includes the Saudi embassy, wants to rename the street after the man who was killed, allegedly, by the Saudis. Look, this guy was murdered. It was wrong. But the idea that you name a street in D.C. after Khashoggi, this is a man who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's out there. You can find the details. Who was very, very close to Osama bin Laden, and who in his last article, his last op-ed piece before he was murdered, wrote of the values, the virtues of theocracy, and how we need to have more theocracy and less democracy in the Middle East. It would be akin to naming a street after Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current head of al-Qaeda. It would be like naming a street after Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11. We don't do that in America. We have separation of church and state. and those people who don't believe in representative democracy aren't honored by having streets named after them. So, look, there's a reason BC voted more than 95% for Hillary Clinton. It really is a very different part of America.
Right. So what did Kel Thomas once say? Something like 42 square miles surrounded by reality, something like that. I wanted to get your reaction to this study, Center for Immigration Studies put out analyzing numbers from 2014. They find 63% of non-citizens using a welfare program grows to 70% for those who have been in America for 10 years or more. And how does that inform, in your opinion, what the president should do with respect to going to the mat, even for the quote-unquote government shutdown over border wall funding?
Yeah, it's stunning. He tweeted out yesterday that billions of dollars would be saved if we sealed the border, and he's absolutely right. If you look at those figures, you've got millions of people who are suckling at the teat of the government subsidies that are provided for by who? You and me. We pay for illegal aliens to get welfare in America. Think of the lives that are being ruined right now by the influx of fentanyl and other drugs across the southern border. Think of the money that would be saved, the lives that would be saved if we built the wall and we had E-Verify. With regards to what the president is doing in the shutdown, look, Chuck Schumer lost last time. The narrative was not on the side of the Democrats. Because Americans saw that one party, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi's party, was on the side of illegals and on the side of criminals in sanctuary cities, whilst the Republicans were on the side of U.S. citizens and the military. When you're prepared to shut down the government, take money away from our armed forces in the name of protecting illegals, that doesn't look very good. So I think the president, once again, is going to call Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi's bluff, and we'll see who blinks first.
He is Sebastian Gorka, former deputy assistant to President Trump, author of the book Why We Fight, Defeating America's Enemies with No Apologies. And in just a month, beginning of the year, catch him, his America First program on Salem in Chicago. He'll be on at 10 p.m. Sebastian Gorka, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. God bless. Have a great one.
You too.
Yep. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Well, well, well. I go to read Kristen McQuarrie's column in the Tribune. And
it's your BFF.
Lo and behold, Ann B. Davis's bowling ball has been profiled and outed.
Yeah, he decided one day, you know what? His weight crept up to 275 pounds, and he decided, I've got to make a change. And so, no sweets, no tweets.
No, he connected the dots.
Yeah, because this is such, you know, a volatile time, and he was constantly tweeting. Very clever tweets, so I have to say. I missed him when he took a break, but he associated his weight gain with his tweeting and with social media and how it was consuming everything. On the weekends, he'd sit on the couch, always looking at his phone instead of being active with his young boys, ages 7 and 8, and he was too active in social media and eating. Sorry.
And so he drops 50 pounds, and now he's slowly back on social media.
He never gave up conservative talk radio, though.
Which just means our show.
Exactly. Why doesn't he just say Kristen McQuarrie? Dan and Amy.
Well, it wasn't him. It was Kristen McQuarrie wouldn't name our show. She's ashamed of you.
I think she's ashamed of you.
That could be. So he's Ann B. Davis's bowling ball is back, which is good because he's a funny, funny guy.
And you could see.
There he is.
Yeah, he's tweeting again. And you could see his weight loss on his Twitter feed, which is ABDSBB, Ann B. Davis's bowling ball. But you know what? I just think it's good for him. He kept what his deal was, he would only eat 500 calories a day. Mm-hmm. Which that's a big spread to go from what he was eating to that. Normally you consume about 1,200 calories a day, but he would have, you know, 80 calorie yogurt at night, and his wife prepared smaller meals for him. So I'm happy for him.
Yeah, right? Congratulations for taking off the weight. And
it's a huge accomplishment.
And
really.
But now his nom de plume provides no anonymity. Everybody will know who Ann B. Davis's bowling ball is, at least if you read McCreary's column. I'm not going to tell you. That's called a tease, trying to drive up the views of her McCreary's column.
Yeah, and again, the title, A Weight Loss Journey, No Sweets, No Tweets. It's very well written, and congratulations, Mike. And to his wife, we're very proud of him.
And to his sons, who get their dad back from Twitter.
Hey, it's a thing. Why do you think kids, when they're younger, they steal our phones so that we pay attention to them? They do.
I was tweeting.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Did you say something?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
The Campus Beat, the Campus Beat. Yeah, the Campus Beat.
Oh, no. Now they've done it. The cultural Marxists on campus took it too far. They've endangered the Harvard chapter of Amy's sorority.
It's the Eta Theta chapter of
what?
Kappa Kappa Gamma. Don't I even sound like a bimbo even saying that, even with my Kim Carnes voice?
You ate a what?
No, the Eta Theta chapter of Kappa Kappa Gamma. So yesterday, Kappa Kappa Gammas joined five other sororities and fraternities and filed a lawsuit against Harvard because they're penalizing students who join single-gender clubs such as sororities and fraternities. They said in the federal lawsuit that it was a violation of their freedom to associate and that the university was using threats and intimidation against the students.
Kappa Alpha Theta apparently has joined that suit, too. As we have friend listeners of the show, that was the sorority she was in, and they're so she.
Oh yeah,
wanted
Thetas
to make
are
sure.
Good. They're okay. They're not Kappa Kappa Gammas, but they're second best.
How? Why are you the best?
Because we are. Because we're smarter. Do you want me to name a list of alumni?
Come on. Why are you the best?
Because I was a Kappa, and my sister and my grandma, Kappa Kappa Grandma. We're all Kappas.
Uh-huh.
They're tall blondes. Let's just, you know, anybody who knows anything about Kappas. And we're smart.
I will shock you to learn I was not a participant in the Greek system.
No. So, I thought you were a beta for sure, or a sigma chi.
Yeah, I don't
really you set that one out?
Know of what you speak.
Well, it's a great time to, you know, bond with other women and to, you know, you have.
Right, especially for the men.
No. See, that's the thing. So Harvard wanted the sororities to be all-inclusive. It can't be single gender. It's got to be multiple gender and, you know, people that are transitioning and all that. And the Kappas said no, and they shut down the Eta Theta chapter, and they did not have Rush this year. And then now eventually they're shutting it down and suing the university. Because listen to this. If you didn't comply with their demands, if you didn't let men in or transgenders, You couldn't be captain of a varsity athletic team. You couldn't become a Rhodes Scholar. You couldn't have other.
I mean, what chance of that is?
Hey.
I mean, what chance was there of a cap? I mean, you know, let's just be honest with one.
No, there's a lot of things. You couldn't get academic scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, oh, you know what? We're not. You couldn't be granted prestigious fellowships or scholarships. So they just said, you know what? We're shutting it down, and we're suing you for trying to take away our First Amendment right for freedom of association. Oh, I love Kappas. Oh, I'll wear my sweatshirt tomorrow.
Who would have thought that the cool, beautiful people would lead the way against the totalitarian re-educators? I mean, it's stunning.
Well, you guys thought we were
thought
bimbos
Amy
all
Jacobson
these years.
And all
not.
Of her tall, blonde friends would be the salvation for Western civilization. I mean, I didn't see it coming. I got to tell you.
Well, and then the Thetas, they're very good looking too, you know. So your Theta friend, she sounds like a smart woman.
And it's not just on the female side.
Oh, the men are doing it too.
Yeah, these pretty boy.
All right, name the frats.
Sigma Chi.
Oh, sweetheart. We have a lot of lists, Sigma Chi. Tom Sudeikis is Sigma Chi.
Yeah, pretty boy.
My friend Peter.
That's what I said.
That's a big listener of the show. He's Sigma Chi at Northwestern.
He's
John Wayne was a Sigma Chi.
Faye Dandies, except for John Wayne.
Yeah, he's a man.
Sigma Chi.
Brett Baer's Sigma Chi.
Brett Baer's Sigma Chi?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. So I said the cool, beautiful people on TV, all the successful people, successful because they're good looking.
Well, Tom Selleck's a Sigma Chi. I mean, seriously, it's just absurd.
Well, the Sigma Chi chapter at Stanford, of all places.
What did they do?
An administrator encouraged Sigma Chi to take down the American flag flown in front of its house in order to improve its image on campus. Yeah, seriously.
Tom Sadeka, call in 312-642-5600 because he donates to the alumni.
I don't like Tom Sadeka could get into Stanford. Come on.
He went to Northern Illinois. Northern Illinois, Stanford, same thing. Academic geniuses.
Uh-huh.
I come out of those schools.
Sigma Chi would not comply.
Good for Sigma Chi and Hulk.
Yeah.
Anybody who's Sigma Chi knows what that means.
This administrator that was assigned to Sigma Chi told Sigma Chi to do a better job to make itself an ally of the university.
Did they want him to put up a different flag than the American flag, or just take down the American flag
to improve the fraternity's image on campus? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. I think John in Oak Park has it nailed. How about that, John? Who would have thought? John in Oak Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, it's about time we have a reverse Revenge of the Nerds situation taking place. And that's been the whole problem. The nerds had too much power for too long, and the jocks need to take it back. Thank you.
All right, yeah, exactly. Wow. Thanks, John. Probably one of the pretty boy jocks. Got all the kappas and thetas and gamma ray betas or whatever that is.
I felt the thighs.
Pablo Lozano is a Stanford student who brought the Sigma Chi story to the public's attention. And he talked about this administrator he encountered that was pressing Sigma Chi to take down the American flag.
Yeah. Huh.
Lozano found the administrator suggesting that the mere sight of the American flag is offensive. Uh-huh. Really interesting. But again, the Sigma Chi, the pretty, smart, privileged people at Stanford, standing up for America. Who would have thunk it? I think it's great.
I love it.
Congratulations.
Sigma Chi's, SAEs, Thetas and Kappa Kappa Gammas are all part of that lawsuit against Harvard, including two other students who felt discriminated based, you know, they didn't get leadership positions because of this new rule at Harvard.
We all owe you, Amy Jacobson, and the sisterhood of the Alpha Ray Beta traveling pants, whatever it is, a debt of gratitude.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
And also real quick on that story, Delta Gamma, they just shut down and now their house is sitting idle and they owe some $50,000. But they weren't going to comply either with this, letting men and transgenders into their sorority.
I also forgot an important point about that Stanford American flag story, Sigma Chi chapter. Not only did they refuse to take down the American flag, despite pressure from the administration via one of these, you know, residential life liaison goons, they replaced the 3-foot by 5-foot American flag with a 4-foot by 6-foot American
and
flag.
And Hoke, go Sigma Chi's. I love it.
All right, let's hear from pretty boy Tom Sadeka, Sigma Chi. Tom from Barrington, you're on.
Good morning, guys. I would have called in sooner, but I was getting my eyebrows waxed, and my beautician said, they just mentioned your name on the radio, you got to call in.
Sure.
When the sweetheart of Sigma Chi says, call in, you got to call in.
Sorry to take you away from your day of beauty, yes.
No, listen, that's okay. Much work to be done. The Stanford story, I heard it last night, was unbelievable, and I'm proud of the guys there to make the flag big. And I tell you what, if this really becomes a flashpoint, I think we're going to have the biggest Sigma Chi walkout to Stanford, and Stanford's going to rue the day when bums like us appear on campus.
I love it. All right, Tom.
In support. You guys have a great day. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Get back to your mud bath or whatever it is you're doing.
Right. Exfoliation time, I think that what it is now.
We were. I wanted to switch gears here. I mean, if we can stop with fraternity sorority chat for just
a
minute.
You know what? I'll bring you a Sigma Chi sweatshirt to wear on the air tomorrow.
No, I couldn't. That would be.
That's all right.
Be misrepresentation. I'm not a Sigma Chi.
Well, you can still wear the sweatshirt.
I would devalue the brand.
You can't go in the chapter room, Dan.
I can't go in public with that on. this story we covered all last week, and we're going to continue to cover because trial lawyers and the big government press corps and Dem politicians are all conspiring to ignore the truth and to frighten people and to demagogue this issue. And it's about Sterigenics in Willowbrook, the Sterigenics facility, and the release of ethylene oxide. We've done story after story in DuPage Policy Journal, dupagepolicyjournal.com, so you can go check out all the backstory. But I wanted to highlight this piece of it because we focused in on the Tribune's reporting in particular and this propagandist Michael Hawthorne, who's been rinsing and repeating and repurposing the junk science emanating from the leftists in the community. And so junk journalism plus junk science. We talked to him last week, Rich Trupek from the Heartland Institute, and he directed us to an Illinois EPA permit issued for the Chicago Tribune's Freedom Center printing facility on the Chicago River near the city's, you know, northwest side. The Tribune is actually permitted to emit more ethylene oxide than is Sterigenics. You hear that? Sterigenics, the billboards on the interstates, and the trial lawyers' junk science. The Tribune is permitted to emit more ethylene oxide than is Sterigenics. And unlike Sterigenics, the Tribune is not required to control its emissions. When's Michael Hawthorne's story about the Tribune coming out? Sterigenics, the Tribune, 39,800 pounds per year. What do you have to say about that, all of you utopian socialists in the Western burbs, about your zero tolerance policy? Because you don't understand it's, you know, dosage that makes the poison. Too much water, you could die, right? Should we ban water? Zero tolerance for it? Morons, junk scientists, virtue signaling simps. 39,800 pounds per year, the Tribune is of ethylene oxide, the Tribune is permitted to emit, as well as another 165,000 pounds of volatile organic material, widely considered responsible for urban ozone pollution or smog. 144,000 pounds of particulate matter blamed by the EPA for causing human breathing problems. This is according to the Illinois EPA permit issued for the Tribune's printing facility. How do you like me now, Michael Hawthorne? Trial lawyers, Dem politicians. Spread the word. Trupek goes on to say, Hawthorne's lack of understanding of basic scientific concepts, coupled with his determination to twist facts to support his central hypothesis that industries poison people, has led to grossly inaccurate assertions in his reporting and scared people unnecessarily, like decent, fair-minded people, not the professional agitators and idle housewives of Hinsdale. Junk journalism plus junk science. The junk political culture of Chicago Metro.
Changing gears here, we'd like to remind you about our annual campaign to help those less fortunate during the holiday season. I know we've talked a lot about food for the poor and our efforts to help those in need in Haiti, but it's so amazing. 80% of the population live below the poverty line, and it's 54% in abject poverty. I mean, it's unbelievable. They fight for food every day. Some girls don't go to school because they walk miles to get clean water for their family. And you can make a difference. We're asking for a one-time donation of just $80. But if all you have is $50, $40, that's fine. We want you to call 844-862-HOPE. That's 844-862-4673. It takes just a few minutes. Have your credit card ready. They'll take your information. You can go on with your day knowing that you've helped so many. Or go to 560theanswer.com/food.
And the other way to participate is through the Business Benefactor Program. Again, we need business support to get to our goal. 3,000 children, food for a year, water for life. We have gotten support from many businesses already. Matthew Hickey, Law of Chicago, Signature Bank, AmericanEagle.com, Cafe Salsa, Palatine Complete Dental, Chris Jacobson Associates, Century 21 affiliated, Twin Supplies of Oak Brook, many more. And we appreciate their support. If you'd like to join them in supporting this worthy cause, the Business Benefactor Program works like this. You make a $2,500 tax-deductible donation to Food for the Poor, and we at AM560 give you 40 60-second commercials to promote your business on our airwaves, prime broadcasting hours, weekdays, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. The way to enroll, call our sales manager, Ann Jeanette. 847-472-8951 is her number. 847-472-8951, and Ann Jeanette will get you squared away.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Our friend Michael Goodwin over at the New York Post, along with a couple of Post reporters, had the opportunity to visit with President Trump last week, sat down for an extended interview, covered a lot of ground, in particular on the Mueller investigation, as things are ramping up, both in terms of rhetoric as well as, well, according to Andy McCarthy's interpretation of what he sees happening, Mueller's effort to put together a report, not a prosecution.
Yeah, a sentencing memo for Flynn will be released today. The sentencing memo for Manafort will be released on Friday.
And all of the sentencing recommendations relate to not participating in a conspiracy, to lying to the FBI. A report, not a prosecution. That's what's forthcoming, according to former Manhattan Assistant U.S. Attorney Andy McCarthy. Well, let's find out what the president thinks per what he had to say to Michael Goodwin. Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor. Michael, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
So your impressions of what President Trump had to say about Mueller during your time with him?
Well, you know, interestingly, to the point you were just making, I was able to ask the president, how does he see this ending? And his basic answer was, I don't know. And then he launched into the ripping of Mueller, comparing it to McCarthyism, saying it is McCarthyism, and going after Democrats at the same time, who are now taking over the House and planning to subpoena him, you know, to bury him and the administration in subpoenas and investigations. I think the combination of these two things, of Mueller clearly moving towards some kind of conclusion, probably a report, because of this Justice Department issue prohibition on indicting a sitting president. So it looks to be like it will be a report to the Attorney General and then end up in Congress for any hearings or impeachment articles if they want to draw them up. I think we can assume the Democrats will. But I think the president's frame of mind, and this is what struck me the most, is that he is prepared for this war. This is clearly, he was in a sunny disposition, by and large, genial, very friendly, and answered every question we had. Nothing was out of bounds. And yet, I think in his heart, there is this fury over Mueller, over the Democrats, over the media, and this sense that the good things of his administration, the accomplishments, are buried by all of this, what he regards as just an illegitimate attack on his presidency, and that it not only shows no signs of ending, it is clearly now going to ramp up because the Democrats were rewarded for their behavior by taking over the House. So I think the president, I wouldn't say he's alarmed, but I think he is certainly on guard now. And as we know, he is a counterpuncher. He will not take these punches without hitting back.
Yeah, and yesterday he lashed out at his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, on Twitter, saying that Cohen makes up stories and should serve a full and complete sentence for fraud. Some are saying that that's witness tampering, and I just wanted to, saying that he's intimidating the witness. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I think the Cohen situation is by and large finished. I mean, he has pled to the various charges. I don't think there's anything that Trump can do to intimidate anybody who is basically now at the compassion of the prosecutor. I mean, Mueller has controlled, he has dictated these statements that Cohen has made in his pleas. So I don't think there's an attempt to intimidate Cohen. It may be that others will look at that and say, wow, I don't want to incur the president's wrath. But I think that's a hypothetical, and it seems to me you would need more than a statement, a tweet from the president to say he's guilty of intimidating a witness.
It seems to me also you have this inverse relationship between the quality of evidence and the hyperbolic statements from Democrats. In other words, as the evidence declines, the hyperbole increases. And we saw that this weekend with Nadler, with Schiff, you know, based on this Cohen plea agreement, suggesting, well, you know, now we finally have the dots connecting of this Russian collusion conspiracy. When in point of fact, if you read, as Catherine Herridge did at Fox and others, if you actually read what was in those documents, it's almost exculpatory with respect to Trump and any business dealings with the Russians, or much less any political collusion on a go-forward basis in the 2016 election cycle. So do you agree with Andy McCarthy's assessment that what you really have is Mueller being front-run by Democrats to come out with a damning report that is without evidence, at least in terms of collusion?
Well, I think this has always been an issue that even go back and let's say that let's stipulate that that there was some reason for an investigation, which the FBI began in the summer of 16. Here we are in December of 18, and Mueller inherited that original investigation in May of 17 and has continued it. So you basically have an investigation for 2.5 years, and you have no evidence that we are aware of that shows the president committing any crimes, having any underhanded dealings directly or indirectly that his campaign would benefit from Russia. I mean, the whole collusion is not a crime. It's not even defined in any way. But let's just take it at its broadest sense. What have we learned in 2.5 years that would cast doubt on Donald Trump's legitimacy as president? I would submit nothing. We have seen lots of smoke, and people have seized on every jot and tittle to declare the election invalid, but that's the Democrats. And the problem is the melding, the exploitation of Mueller for partisan purposes. And I think that is the great harm that has been done to this country and to this presidency. If you have the goods, let's see them. If you don't have the goods after 2.5 years, it seems a reasonable time to admit that. I mean, this is not to be an eternal investigation. And the president, in our interview, said that he thinks Mueller wants it to go on until the end of his life. Not Trump's life, Mueller's life. You know, lifetime employment.
CNN described the interview that you had with him as that he was out of his mind, that he's unhinged. And again, you said his demeanor, he was very friendly and cordial. And
yeah, I didn't realize they had said that. I mean, that's so far from the Donald Trump that we saw and B that we described. Yeah. I mean, I have interviewed him a few times in person and over the phone. He is, to me, always focused. He's got a lot of things on his mind, as every president does. And he's a fast talker. He's from New York.
Yeah.
He doesn't dwell and sort of gaze at his navel. He says what's on his mind and moves to the next subject. Out of his mind. That's insane. I mean, that is classic CNN wanting that to be true. regardless of the facts. The facts be damned. This is what we want. I mean, that's the media environment that the president is operating in. And sometimes, guys, I step back and you look at what the president has accomplished. Despite that media, despite the New York Times, I mean, every story in the New York Times on the front page today is an anti-Trump tone. Whether it's about pitying the migrants, it's a hard line on China. What, we should take a soft line on China? I mean, all of these things are all coming from the same root. We hate Donald Trump. We will destroy Donald Trump. And so everything is seen through that lens.
I wanted to see if in your conversation Jim Comey's name came up at all. He announced this week he was dropping his challenge to the subpoena from the House Judiciary Committee. He will testify before House Jude in private, you know, at this late date with the power about to change hands next month. I don't know what will be accomplished with further testimony from Comey, but whether or not the president found that to be important.
Yes. I mean, the Comey, the firing of Comey came up. I mean, he raised it. As I recall, that he raised it. And again, it's just, you know, thank God I fired Comey because look what was uncovered. And again, I think this goes to his anger at you have the Mueller thing going on for 2.5 years, but nothing that he's aware of. Mueller has no interest. Where is the Clinton server? What? Why was it never examined? I mean, all of those things that have been mentioned in passing, but it's over, right? The whole Clinton thing is over. Comey seems to have escaped any prosecution. McCabe, remember that referral on McCabe to the, right. I think, the Eastern? Whatever happened to that? How long does it take? But this sense of Mueller every day in the headlines. So I think the president has a great sense of resentment that he has been treated unfairly by a double standard within the Justice Department. And I can't disagree.
One of the things that came out from your interview as well is the idea that he would not take using his pardon power off the table for Paul Manafort or anybody else at this juncture. And I wonder if you could provide any more context to that in terms of how was it sort of even keel that he said that? Like, this is just at my disposal. I'm not going to telegraph what I'm going to do. Or was it sort of wink and a nod, or what was his manner around that statement?
Yeah, there was no wink and nod. This was an immediate reaction. My sense that he said it had not been discussed. I think he probably meant, you know, with Manafort's lawyers or Manafort himself. But I got the impression that this was a decision that had been made. He was not making a decision on the spot. I think that decision had been that he had made that decision earlier, and I don't know why he put it that exactly that way, that I wouldn't take it off the table. Why would I take it off the table? I think it's simply a statement of fact that I would be crazy not to at least consider this. And I think, again, it's important to view it from his perspective, just to understand that is, he and his people have been treated unfairly, and the other side has been given a free pass to break the law. That, you know, that is his view of what is going on, what has been going on, and what continues to go on. And I think he senses it's not going to go away, that now that the Democrats have the House and that Mueller is clearly coming to some conclusion, it looks like, it's only going to get worse in the immediate future.
Did he express any concern about his son, Donald Trump Jr., as it seems clearer and clearer that Mueller is looking at the WikiLeaks, leaking of emails, the Trump Tower meeting involving Trump Jr., and then this whole, you know, Russian business deal, the tower that wasn't built in Russia. But with respect to Trump Jr., is he worried at all about exposure for his son?
Yeah, that did not come up, and I have to say we did not ask specifically about that. The people he did mention were Jerome Corsi, Papadopoulos, Roger Stone, and Manafort, of course. that all of them, and Michael Cohen, the pressure that both Stone and Corsi and Papadopoulos have talked about, the pressure, as they put it themselves, to lie, that Mueller is trying to induce them to lie in order to get leniency. The president strongly believes that is true. He believes that, you know, he says, I've never met Corsi, but that he mentioned Papadopoulos. He said, look, he might have been foolish, Papadopoulos, but you look at what Papadopoulos is saying these days about Mifsud. Trump, I believe he was referring to Mifsud, said this so-called professor who was being paid by the United States government, it looks like, to infiltrate the Trump campaign and to entice them into committing crimes by acknowledging or showing that they had some relationship with the Russians. Mifsud was paid, Trump has been told, apparently, up to $2 million for this contract. We know Christopher Steele was paid. So he wants to know, why is all that okay? Why is no one investigating that? And now, I mean, the House Republicans, some of them were to some point. They didn't get very far. But now that's gone because the Democrats taking the House will have no interest in any of that.
He is Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist and Fox News contributor. You can find his a recounting of his interview with President Trump at NewYorkPost.com, NYPost.com. Michael, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
We love our listeners and we love because they're philanthropic and they help those who are less fortunate. And we need your help. We're in the throes of our annual Food for the Poor Christmas campaign to help those less fortunate this year, asking for a one-time gift of $80. But if all you could do is $50 or $40, that's fine. But $80 will provide food for a year and water for life for a child in Haiti. Call the number, 844. I have it memorized now. 844-862-HOPE. See how I did that?
Yeah. 844. That's pretty good.
862-HOPE or go to 560theanswer.com/food.
Business Benefactor Program is another way to help, as many of our entrepreneurial friends have already done. Signature Bank, Cafe Salsa, AmericanEagle.com, many others. That is a $2,500 tax-deductible donation to Food for the Poor. And then from us, you get 40 60-second commercials to promote your business on our airwaves, primetime hours, weekdays, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. And the way to enroll in that program, like our other friends in the business community did, is by calling our sales manager, Anjanette, and see if you memorize her number.
Her number is 847-472-8951. 847-472-8951. It is the best deal in all of Chicagoland broadcasting. $2,500 tax deductible. The money goes to Food for the Poor, and we will give you 41-minute commercials that Dan could voice and that I won't voice because my voice sounds again like I've gargled glass.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.